Hello and welcome to Dig Me Up Lady with Casey Martin Stone, and we're having another solo cast this week. I'm going to dig up gardening. Not just digging up the garden, but looking at it archaeologically. And yeah, I hope you enjoy it because gardens have a lot to do with archaeology. You think they might disappear over time, but you can actually learn a lot about people from their gardens. And coincidentally, I've been spending the weekend gardening. It's really quite nice. So yeah, settle in and enjoy. I know it's been a 2-week break or something since the last episode. We'll be getting back on track shortly. We've had lockdowns and I've had a 10-day conference, which I'll tell you a bit about shortly. So yeah, it's all coming together quite nicely. And out of all of these things that are happening, there'll be some pretty exciting announcements coming out in a few months. But for now, settle in and enjoy another episode of Dig Me Up Later. Welcome to Dig Me Up Later for the solo cast of Digging Up Gardens. Particular shout out to all of my Patreon supporters. It is so nice to have you here. And yeah, if other listeners would like to join the Patreon, you get all sorts of things like early access to episodes and stickers of things I made. And yeah, all sorts of extra goodies. So yeah, have a think about that. If you can contribute, it really does help me to put together the podcast each month and put the time into it that I need to. I'm also going to line up a bunch of guests, which I'm getting pretty excited about. And so over the next few weeks, we'll start having some much more interesting people than me. So yeah, today I have just been gardening. And actually, it's funny. I've come in for lunch because it's the hottest part of the day and I've had to turn the aircon off so there's not enough background noise in this podcast. But I'm actually watching a video and I've muted it, but it's still playing in the background. Do you ever go down those rabbit holes? I was eating lunch and scrolling through Twitter on my phone and there was an archaeologist on there who asked other archaeologists for recommendations for napping videos. Napping is the process of working stone to make it into stone tools. And I learned how to nap at uni way back in about 1997. Gosh, I feel old now. But it just feels so cool to take a chunk of rock and make it into a functional thing. And I remember the first one I ever made, I took the perfect flake off the core. The core is the mother rock. You use a hammer stone to break off flakes. And I thought, oh, I wonder how sharp that is. And I just ran it across the palm of my hand. And I don't recommend that you do that because it was fucking sharp. So, yeah, it cut me and I bled. So, anyway, I saw this request for recommendations and someone recommended a guy who has a YouTube channel called Nap Time. And the first video I looked at, it's about 45 minutes long, which I thought, oh geez, I better stop and go and record the podcast now. He has taken the base off a glass bottle and is napping it into an arrowhead. And you do this with pressure flaking, not your percussion, your big heavy chuck a hammer stone at it. And so I've never done pressure flaking. It always struck me as a little bit dangerous, but I'm watching this video and thinking, I could actually do that. I think it would probably be easier, more intentional than doing this standard percussion napping of stone. And this is really interesting to me, particularly because when I'm out bush, I sometimes find Aboriginal artifacts from the time when white people were just arriving into the top end about 150 years ago. And so they brought with them glass bottles, and the Aboriginal people would take the bottle bases off and nap them into tools the same way they were doing their stone tools. So I've seen beautiful arrowhead kind of things, we call them points here, made out of purple glass or green glass or clear glass, and they're just so beautiful. And sometimes what I find is the core left over, so the bit of bottle that has had all of these flakes taken off around the sides. And just the technique is amazing. Oh, one of the other things I found once was there's a thing called a shovel-nosed spear, and the stone tool on the end of it was shovel-shaped. We label things quite easily here in Australia. Red back spider has a red back. Red belly black snake has a red belly. So the shovel-nosed spear has a nose like a shovel. And I found one made of metal. And so it was in a really old mine site from the 1870s. And so it's one of the things that I love is that Aboriginal people were just experimenting with all these new materials and doing the old things in new ways. And yeah, I love finding traces of these contact times. So I was watching this video and it's making a glass arrowhead, he calls it. He's a British guy. He's learned how to make arrowheads from lots of different cultures around the world. And I'm looking at it and thinking, yeah, that's super cool. Now, here's something for you to try if you're interested. Next time you have a drink of beer, if you drink beer, I don't. When you've got an empty beer bottle, drop a nail in it with the pointy bit of the nail pointing down to the bottom of the bottle. And then probably a good idea to wear gloves, sturdy ones like gardening gloves. And with your thumb, cover over the mouth of the bottle and just gently shake it up and down. Not too hard or you're going to hurt yourself, but just shake it up and down. And the nail tip will, you know, tap, 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 tap against the bottle bottom. And the coolest thing that I learned watching this video was that after a while of doing that, the bottom of the bottle will just fall off. There'll be bits of glass that break off first. So do it over a bit of tarp or something and, you know, look after yourself, wear pants. Yeah, and that base of the bottle, you can then nap into an arrowhead. I'm not going to tell you how to do that. You can Google that shit yourself. But I'm thinking today, I might go to like the dollar store or something and buy some cheap, pretty coloured glass bottles and just play. That'd be really cool. So I'd have to get a tarp and put it out in the garden and sit in the shade and, yeah, use my gardening gloves. Circling around that gardening thing, aren't I? Yeah, so I'll let you know. I'll report back on whether I ever get around to making glass arrowheads, and maybe they could be a Patreon reward for some of the higher levels there. But I'd have to feel like I'm actually good at it before I think they're okay enough to give away as a reward. Like, how egotistical is it to go, oh yeah, I cracked some glass, here you go, have a bit of broken glass. Sometimes I think I just wander through the bush looking at pointy rocks, which is literally true, but they have meaning and they have a story and it's important. And so, yeah, that thing about archaeology is that it never tells the whole story of a person or people or culture. It is a snapshot of all that remains. And so all the organic stuff is usually gone, most of it. We'll hear more about that when we talk about gardening. I haven't really planned this episode. I'm just talking. And we'll see how long it goes for. Hopefully, you know, not bore you senseless. So archaeology looks at what is left behind. And that phrase is probably applied in two senses. What's left behind in as much as what has lasted, things of stone and metal, ceramics, all those really sturdy materials, but things that are left behind by people. Yeah. So basically, I see dead people and sort out their trash. But one of the things that it shows me is that eventually everything becomes rubbish. Everything is trash. But it all has meaning of a kind, and it can be significant or insignificant, ephemeral or long-lasting, and people do things for a reason. And so when you have a look at an object, you reverse engineer the story. You figure it out. And sometimes in doing that, you actually tell a story that's more about yourself and your own biases than it is about the people in the past. But generally, if you do your job properly, you actually can get a really deeper understanding of who people were. And one of the things I love about stone tool studies and glass studies is that if you really get deep down into it, you can learn all sorts of things about, you know, their sophisticated understanding of the fracture mechanics of stone and the chemical properties of stone and Mohs scale of hardness, which is physics, and then everything from looking at collections of stone tools, you can figure out whether the person was right-handed or left-handed that made it. Some people can actually recognize stone tools made by a particular person. Like they're an artwork that has a signature in the way that a drawing by Picasso can be recognized on site. So I don't know enough about that level of stone tool analysis, but I have done quite a bit, and so I can recognize tools from a particular region, I can recognize stone from a particular quarry, I can I've analysed this amazing site that I love, that I keep going back to in my mind, where people were manufacturing blades and axes in a multi-stage process across the landscape. So the original boulders of rock that were outcropping on a hilltop were massive, like up to a meter wide, and they had to break this down into cores of a reasonable size. And you just think of the amount of force that's required to bust open a rock that big. And so this site is just amazing. So they'd take cores and then they'd wander off down towards the creek where they would sit in the shade and nap with a K, canap. And so along the way, they sat at a bit of a flat spot halfway up the hill and started shaping or taking off the basic flakes out of these cores, and they'd take it down to the creek side and they'd do the next stage. And the ones they left behind are the ones that were a bit dodgy, like it didn't quite hit properly. So usually when you find a scatter of stone artifacts that have been flaked, the sharp edge is called the termination, the end point. And a feather termination is the good one. And there's a whole range of reasons why you might not get a good edge when you do the original napping. And so what I find along these creek banks is they just discarded all the dodgy ones and took all the good ones. And then as you work your way out from this quarry site, like kilometres and kilometres away, you find dropped isolated artifacts, and they're blade blanks and axe blanks. So they're obviously going to be refining it and working it down later. And then these things are traded hundreds of kilometres away, and I see them across the territory. And I always love it when I find a stone in a site that isn't local to that area and I know where it's from. It's just like, I can see the connection between these people. And a lot of people would walk into these sites and not even know they are a site. They would go, there's rocks on the ground, but they don't know which ones belong there and which don't. They don't know which ones were made by people and which ones weren't. So I love that ability to read culture in the landscape as I walk it, because it makes me feel connected to it. And there's just something about being in nature that relaxes me. So, yeah, a garden is your own little patch of nature of a kind. It's I divide the world into two categories, natural and cultural. So natural is untouched and unmodified, and cultural is everything that's been moved or made or modified by humans. And so, yeah, a garden is not natural because it's intentionally created. And I think of it as art. And I'm a renter. I did own a home once when I was married many, many years ago. Got divorced in 2010, sold the house, and I've been renting ever since. And so it's a really interesting thing to go from owning your own home to not owning a house and also not being able to get into the housing market, which I'm sure a lot of you are sharing that challenge these days. It's a shitty situation to be in. And so I rent a two-bedroom apartment, and it's lovely. Like it's comfortable. It's mine. I've been here 6 years. And to start with, there was a garden at the front that eventually like deteriorated and died because there's a fungus killing golden cane palms in Darwin, and they were the trees in the front yard that were screening and providing privacy. And then there were taller palm trees that got termites or got blown over in a cyclone, and or you know, one of them smashed into the roof in the cyclone, and so you know, cut them down and get rid of everything. And then eventually the front courtyard was just bare dirt that was root bound from all these palm roots. Don't ever grow palm trees if you can help it. They're awful, shitty, messy things that kill everything around them. So, yeah, I for a long time had this bare dirt garden that was miserable and I hated it. And I was growing things in buckets and pots in the backyard just to screen the backyard fence, and the garden beds there had the same issues. And I was kept asking the landlord, can you please rip out the stumps and roots in the front garden and I'll put something there? And she didn't want to. And there were arguments over which bit of the front yard was hers and which bit was the body corporate's, and so nobody wanted to pay for anything, and consequently I just had to keep my curtains closed all day so people couldn't see in my windows. And we had a plumber working in the complex here doing the water mains and things, and he had to take a panel off my back fence to get in and dig up the pipes that go into my place. And he saw all these plants in buckets and things, and he said, what are you going to do with those? And I said, well, if the landlord will agree to dig up the roots and stumps out of the front yard, I'll plant them there. And he said, well, I've got my machine here. Do you want me to give it a go? And I said, I'd love you to, because better to seek forgiveness than permission. And so the next morning he turned up half an hour early and started ripping into it. And it was amazing because the palm roots were this thick mat about 15 centimetres deep that it was so matted that the soil was completely sterile. There were no worms, no grubs, no weeds. Nothing would grow there. So he ripped it all out, and then he was lovely. He gave me a truckload of topsoil as well that they had spare from the job, and I gave him four big buckets of plants that he wanted, and I tried to buy him a case of beer, and he wouldn't let me buy him beer, and so then I bought him a box of chocolates. And yeah, and so then spread the topsoil and sent photos to the landlord and said, ta-da, it's done. Would you please like to pay for an irrigation system and path materials? And I've got plants. And also, you know, if she could pay for some manure and hay to improve the condition of the soil. And she said, yeah, and it was like $600 or $700. So I went out and bought the stuff and she reimbursed me. And it was about a year ago, September 2020, 2020 was such an odd year for everyone, and I had been in this in constant motion for 10 years traveling, which is why I like a garden that just looks after itself. Like, I can't have a high maintenance thing. And so 2020 got this garden bare slate and agreement from the landlord, and then I just started gardening, and it's been such a joy to be domestic. I'm not usually a domestic person. I like the idea that I can just walk out and hop on a plane and don't come back for weeks. But then also when I come back, I want it to be home. I want it to be nice and comfortable and that place that I stop. And so, yeah, I planted a garden, and it's been experimental. Even today, so a year into this front garden business, I dug out one plant that was in too sunny a spot, and then I dug out one that was in too shady a spot, and I swapped them over. And then I had a Monstera deliciosa, which is a Swiss cheese plant, you might know it as, or a fruit salad plant. It's that indoor plant that has holes in its leaves, like a philodendron. Anyway, if you know what I'm talking about, you know what I'm talking about. And because in Darwin, we have jungle. It's humid and lovely and shady and lush. And so I had this growing out the backyard. And because indoor plants grow outdoors here, under the stories of everything. And so I dug one up out of the pot in the backyard, and I put it into the front yard today to climb up a tree, a hibiscus, which I hate because it drops shit everywhere, flowers and dead leaves and things. But it's providing shade for all the pretty little things I have underneath it. So it's all just like a work in progress. I have a big blue pot with fish in it. They're guppies, and when I got them they were tiny and dull and black, and now they're all getting these beautiful rainbow coloured tails. I've got one that's got a tail that graduates from blue to purple, and it's got black spots on it, and there's another one that's pink and purple, another one that's orange and silver, and you know, they're all these different beautiful fish. And it's so funny, the other really brilliant thing about growing my garden is how it's connected me to the neighbours. And so I've kind of become the de facto auntie of all the kids in the complex. They come, they like to help me in the garden, and they come for hugs, and they want to have a look at the new flowers and things, and they want to show me their scraped knees. And I love it. Like, the kids here, there's maybe about 12 kids in the complex, and they range in age from about 2 to 12, 14 actually, yeah. And so it's fun, it's just really nice, and I've met all their parents, and yeah, it's lovely. I went for my morning walk this morning. We have our local government elections here, so I walked around to the local high school and cast my vote and came home, and as I was walking in the driveway, one of the kids spotted me out the window of her place, and so she ran out going, "I'm gonna cuddle Karen," and so her little brother went, "I wanna cuddle Karen," and then the little sister went, "I'm gonna cuddle Karen," and then the 14-year-old went, "Oh, me too." And so it was just really, really lovely. And yeah, there you go, Casey. Stands for Karen. I like to say it stands for kick-ass chick. Stands for Karen Cecilia. And I've always hated my name, but I guess you don't get to choose it, do you? Yeah, so Casey, Karen. And it's a funny thing, having two names. Like, I don't really care what people call me. I answer to most things. But I've been more commonly known as Karen in certain times of my life, and then more recently more commonly known as Casey. And so the people from way, way back that used to call me Casey were the closest people to me. And then now that Casey is my more common name, the people that call me Karen are the ones that know me well. And it was kind of funny. I remember I organized a workshop with Will Anderson when he was performing in Darwin. So I invited him to come and speak with all of the comedians from up here, and most of them all know me as KC. And it was really interesting. Will got the time mixed up and he turned his phone off and figured it was 4 o'clock instead of 3 o'clock. And when he turned his phone on, thinking he was half an hour early, he was half an hour late. And so when he got to the session, he was a bit flustered and he's like, oh, fuck. And I turned my phone on and there were like 8 messages from Garen. And everyone's like, who? And so, yeah, it was just a weird thing. But, yeah. I don't know. You can call me Karen. You can call me Casey. Whatever you like. So, gardening. Where does the archaeology come into it? Well, it's about that deliberate decision. And so archaeology in Australia finds gardens very useful. If you're driving through regional Australia and you see introduced plants, you know that that's probably a site of an old house or settlement of some sort, even if there's no buildings left now. And so they're a good signal of people's movements and people's decision to stop in one place. And so one of the things I do when I'm out bush is I find plants that you wouldn't expect to find out the bush in the Northern Territory. Sometimes you find Chinese gardens from the old mine sites down near Pine Creek, which is about 2.5 hours drive south of Darwin. Really hot, rocky country where people were mining for gold in the 1870s. And then you'll find these little pockets of place where there are fig trees and yeah, all sorts of little things, plum trees for the salty plums. They don't actually survive very well. But yeah, and then you find little like garden infrastructure where they've dug channels and wells and things for watering their gardens. And there was a really interesting thing for about the first 50 years or more of the settlement of Darwin. White people wouldn't have survived here without the Chinese because they were the market gardeners. They knew how to grow vegetables in the tropics, which white people didn't. Strange story, 1824, when the British first settled on Melville Island off the north coast here, they brought rice to grow, but they brought sterile rice, so it didn't grow. And they had a really rough trot, actually. They sailed back towards Southeast Asia to Kupang to pick up supplies and their boat got taken by pirates. And yeah, anyway, they were all miserable here. And so one of the other things I find up near the coast, not on the coast, but in the freshwater creeks that go down towards the sea, you find kangkung, which is a Chinese vegetable. It's really nice. Have you ever had kangkung beans you get at a Chinese restaurant? Yeah. So I love it. I like to pick some and eat it as I go, but you've got to be careful because there's crocodiles in there. So, yeah, when you find that, that's usually evidence of Macassan people coming and living locally and growing their vegetables on land while they came for their seasonal fishing projects. So, yeah, they came to get Besh Demir. The Macassans came from Makassar in modern-day Indonesia, and they traded turtle shell and cedar and all sorts of things with the Aboriginal people. They brought in metal axes and and they came for this Besh Demir, which is a sea cucumber. And they traded that up into China, where it was a delicacy and I think also an aphrodisiac. So they would set up camps on the beach and they'd have long channels dug that they would light fires in. And over the fires they'd have these massive metal pots, like a Spanish paella pot, but twice or three times as big as that. And they would boil and smoke the Besh Demir, the trepang, sea slug, sea cucumber, whatever you want to call it, that thing. And so, yeah, I go along these days and often there's not a lot of remnants of those camps, but you find the kangkung and you find the tamarind trees. That's actually the quickest way to find them. Tamarind trees. You'll probably have bought tamarind paste and put it in your Southeast Asian recipes that you cook. And yeah, so these trees are all across the North Coast, across the Kimberley and the Northern Territory. And they usually grow as one central tree and then trees that come off suckers off the end of the roots. And so eventually the central tree dies. And you end up with these groves, and they're beautiful shady trees and in nice spots where there's a good view of the water. So beautiful, beautiful, beautiful things gardens are. I think maybe that drove the craze of indoor plants in 2020, where people just felt a need to connect with nature when we couldn't get out and live our normal lives. So it's been interesting to watch that indoor plant craze, because in Darwin, what you see is certain plants selling out really quickly at Bunnings and then being sold at massively marked up prices on your Facebook marketplace and Gumtree. And what it's also led to is people stealing plants from other people's gardens. And I'm not terribly afraid of that for me. And my garden is basically grown from bits and pieces people give me, and I swap and I grow, and it's all a bit it's all a bit slapdash, and it's all a bit inexpensive, and it's really lovely as a renter to think that I can have a garden, because I didn't think it was possible. So it's, and that also brings up for me this other joy that I've discovered in gardening, and that's just the generosity of fellow gardeners. So how willing they are to share knowledge and cuttings of plants. And yeah, so when all the kids came running out of the house to hug me on my way back this morning, I said to their mum, "Oh gosh, that one's growing well," pointing to a plant in a pot in her front yard. And she's like, "Oh, here." And she dug a bit out of it and just gave it to me. And so I walked home, dug a hole, put it in it, and I'll see how it grows. I've got no idea what it's called. I've got no idea what it needs. I'll just give it a go. And that's what I really love, is connecting with people in a way that's not a commercial transaction. You know how sometimes life and entertainment all feels about money, like what would you pay to be entertained today, or how much will it cost to have a good time? I mean, don't get me wrong, gardening can be very, very expensive. You can spend endless amounts of money on it. But one of the nicest things is that with a few basics, you can just start and then, you know, swap and grow your way to something incredible. And one of the things I love, I went through a phase of buying bromeliads, which are lovely little think of the top of a pineapple, the spiky bit that comes out. It's like that. A pineapple is part of the bromeliad family. And so bromeliads are those kind of spiky, pointy things. And they come in all sizes and colours, and some of them are pointy and spiky, and others aren't. And some are soft and some are hard. And yeah, I just, you know, bought a bunch when I was out one day wandering through plant sales, and I know nothing about them. I stuck their pots in the courtyard in a corner, and they loved it, and I sort of became like the bromeliad queen, and they all had pups. That's what their babies are called. And yeah, I bought one, and it flowered within about, I don't know, 6 or 8 weeks of me getting it. And I went back to the guy that sold it to me to get some more. And I'm like, "Oh, I remember that one. It flowered." And he's like, "Oh, can I have it back?" And I said, No. And it had this most amazing red and yellow flower that lasted 6 months, and it was an architectural masterpiece. No wonder he wanted it back. But when a bromeliad flowers, it puts out pups, and then the main plant dies. I think it took another 6 months to die. Anyway, so it threw out four pups. And I gave one to the mum of the kids that hugged me this morning, and one to my daughter, and two for me, because originally I had three pups and I thought that was one each. And then, hey, bonus, there was another one. I wanted to repot all these bromeliad pups before Christmas, and I didn't get around to it. Guess what I'm doing this afternoon? It'll be September next week. 2021 has been a year. So at least I'm getting around to it. And a lot of them have more pups now. Like, they had pups and then the pups flowered and died and their pups have pups. So there's grandbaby bromeliads happening. Yeah, so when it cools down a bit again, I will head out and do all that repotting. And so, yeah, gardening makes me think of connection. And it's not just from the historical era. There are archaeologists that specialise in paleobotany. And so when you're digging down in an excavation and you can go down, you know, metres through soil, they take soil samples and they analyse them under a microscope and look at the pollens. And I think they're called palynologists, people that specialise in pollen. And so from that, they can tell what plants were in that area at that time. And this is really cool for understanding climate change over time. I mean, climate change is happening now more rapidly than it ever has before, and that's because it's driven by humans pumping carbon into the air. But 10,000 years ago, 11,000 years ago, the last ice age ended, and that caused massive climate change. And so places that were quite, I don't know, temperate areas became deserts, and places that had rainforest became temperate areas, and places that were freshwater country became saltwater country as sea levels rise, as the poles, as the ice melted. And so, yeah, we're going through that on a rapid scale now, and species won't have as much time to adapt as they did back then. But looking at pollens and looking at what's left of gardens enables us to understand what people grew, what was around them, what did they eat, and it gives us a much better idea of people rather than this cliche and stereotype as hunter-gatherers that are more hunters than gatherers, and everything's about that masculine killing sort of stuff. And it's like, where are the vegetarians? I don't know that there were vegetarians back there, but actually vegetables made up the bulk of their diet. It's not like they hunted every day. So yeah, I think that thing about archaeology, how can you get more of the picture? How can you get that next puzzle piece? And so yeah, I like to think on all of these things as I'm pottering around doing not much, that what I'm doing now connects me to what people have done for thousands of years. And it connects me, my tiny little courtyard patch of garden, connects me to people that run massive botanic gardens or big estates or farming, and who started agriculture and how did they decide to do it. And it did evolve at, or develop at, various places around the world at roughly the same time. So, yeah, I like the thinking of experimenting. I don't think of it as taming, although it became that. I think of it like my wet season rainforesty jungly kind of a garden. It's like, we'll just chuck this here and see what happens. And that's a joy. And I think I feel freer to do that when I'm not spending a lot of money on it. Like, if you spent money on something, you want it to work, right? So if you haven't spent any money on it, you can just go, well, if I try this and it doesn't work, what have I lost? Time. Time was going to go anyway. So it's fine. So, yeah, I think also I did spend a bit of money on it because I wasn't spending as much on travel over the last 18 months. So that was my justification. It's like when I buy the occasional lotto ticket, I justify it as just as entertaining as a movie ticket but lasts for longer. Because one of the things I love to do, sometimes you see those big lotteries where it's like $20 million or $40 million, and I would buy a ticket and stick it in my wallet and then go out bushwalking for a couple of weeks. And that's the nicest thing because you can be walking through the bush all day, every day going, I could be $20 million richer and not know it. And yeah, God, that is much more entertaining than a movie ticket that lasts 2 hours. So yeah, that's my weird view of money and the value of entertainment. I really love live entertainment and I will spend money on that. I think of it as an experience rather than a thing. My daughter and I, for birthdays and Christmas and stuff, we do like to try and buy each other experiences or art. Art is an experience in itself. Yeah. So this is a wandering chat. I'm just looking at the time. I've been going for about 40 minutes. Yeah. So I don't know that there's a point to talking about my garden and the archaeology of gardening. I guess I wonder if archaeologists dug up my garden in 1,000 years' time, what would they think of me? Well, they would think that they would be digging up the pollens, and so they would understand that it's a very lush, tropical, green, vibrant colours. I have my first dangling red crab claw heliconias. I say that three times fast. Dangling red crab claw heliconias. There you go. Yeah, they're flowering for the first time. And I thought I had one and now I've got like six and they're amazing. Heliconias are related to the banana family. So if you've seen a banana tree, you might know these. If you've seen a bird of paradise flower, which is really popular down south in temperate areas, heliconias are like that. They're a cross between a bird of paradise flower and a banana tree. And so they just have the most vibrant, pointy, colourful, gorgeous flowers. And when you plant new ones like I did 12 months ago, they don't often flower for the first year or more. And so some I'm waiting for. And these ones are pretty. This one's called Sexy Pink. If you Google Sexy Pink Heliconias, I think all of mine died, but I'll try again. If I have to wait a year to see if they flower, or I have to wait and see if somebody's got some and willing to give me a dead bit. So when you cut off a heliconia stalk, the root, the rhizome, has a growth tip on it sometimes. So you dig that up and you plant it and you hope it goes okay. And usually it does, but the one I got for Sexy Pinks doesn't. In a few weeks' time, the Darwin Botanic Gardens is having a plant sale. There's a volunteer group called the Friends of the Darwin Botanic Gardens, or the George Brown Botanic Gardens they're known as. And so this friends group has a plant sale to raise money for their activities and equipment and stuff. And so they volunteer in the gardens. And so when you go along, these plants are cheaper than nursery prices, really healthy and amazing, like really interesting plants. And so you got to get there at like 8 a.m. and take your own trolley and, you know, fight with people over the best plants. I mean, people don't really fight, but yeah. Anyway, so they put out a notice last week saying that the greenhouse was full. They were having a sale. Get ready. So I'll go to that. Might spend a bit and see what happens. So I'll get some Sexy Pinks there because I think I just love the name, actually. So yeah, there's that. Oh, and the big news about my garden is that I've asked the landlord if we can cut out all the palm roots and the problem trees in the backyard, because some have got termites and stuff in them, so that I can actually plant things. I can take them out of the buckets and pots and put them in the ground. And she's given permission for only the trees that are absolutely essential to go, So, you know, there's rats climb off them and into the roof and that sort of thing. So, still waiting on final confirmation of what's essential and what's not. But when that happens, then, yeah, I get a guy in with a machine, maybe a girl, and they dig up all the roots and stumps and shitty bits in the garden. And then I start again with another blank canvas. So I've been planning. And sometimes what that means is that in the middle of the work day, I'll take a break and I'll stand at the glass door at the back and just stare at my garden and dream of what it can be. And I find a huge amount of joy in doing that. It's really, really lovely. So I hope you have joy of some sort in your life like that. That quiet joy, that comforting thing. And if it involves getting your hands in the dirt, I love it. Because I think that's actually a real human need. And I'm just really lucky that I get to do it for work and fun. So, yeah, I hope that you have a pot plant. I hope that you have a garden. I grew up on a farm where the house paddock was 4 acres. I guess I'm not wrapping up this conversation now. The house paddock was 4.5 acres. And when I was a little kid, up until I was 12, there was like a patch of lawn in the front of the house and a patch of lawn at the back, and the rest of it was just prickles and bindies. And then when I was 12, my dad had his first heart attack, and his doctors said, you need to find a hobby to relax by. And so he chose gardening, which was effectively, he designed the garden and mum did all the work. Not all of it, like we had big days where we all pitched in, but and mum loved getting on the ride-on lawnmower. She had a John Deere thing, and yeah, she could escape the whole family and just go out and mow for hours. So yeah, by the time Phoebe was born when I was 16, the 4.5 acres was lawn with beautiful trees, and I remember that's when I got into the open garden scheme. We'd go around this rural district and visit open gardens. And so now that's something that Phoebe and I have carried through our lives. Like we love going to open gardens. We call it tea and cake in someone's garden. And yeah, and it's just really, really nice. You might recall if you listened to the episode with Richard Margetson. He's a guy I've known for quite a while, but we reconnected when Phoebs and I went to his open garden. So, yeah, I think gardens share a lot of joy. So even if you don't have a garden or even a pot plant, I hope you have a park or a botanic garden nearby that you can visit and just walk through, or lay out a beach towel and read a book. It's one of the things that I loved. When I moved to Adelaide when Phoebe finished school, she stayed in Darwin. And one of the things she started doing on the weekends was going to the botanic gardens with a good book and a beach towel and cheese and crackers and grapes and things and having a little picnic for one. And I love it. I have actually adopted that habit occasionally, and I highly recommend it. Take friends if you want to, but it's, yeah, I think what I like about spending time in gardens is the quiet. I was in my backyard and the neighbour over the back loves birds. He's a refugee who's amazed by Australian birds, and so he puts out seed and attracts all the birds to his place, and then they come and visit me. And so I had a crimson finch in my backyard the other day, and it's the first time I've ever had one of those here. So it's lovely. And the other great thing about my garden, which is not very archaeological, not a lot of chat about archaeology in this one, my front garden within a couple of months started attracting frogs and then lizards and then butterflies and birds. And it is just really, 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 really lovely to sit in my lounge room and look out the window and see lizards chasing lizards and birds. And yeah, so it's nice. It's nice. I don't think of myself as a settled domestic person, but, you know, the world changed for everybody last year, and this is part of the change for me, and I think that's a good thing. And yeah, maybe I'll move on eventually and someone else will inherit my garden, and in 1,000 years' time, maybe someone will dig it up, maybe the building will be long gone, but there'll be pollen in the soil, and they'll say, hey, look, someone chose to grow this. Maybe we can grow it again. And that's the other great thing about archaeology of plants of the past, is that you can take these seeds and grow them again, and you can start crops of ancient grains or revitalize plants that are extinct or almost so. So, yeah, I love it. Let me know what you thought of this episode. I don't often hear from listeners, but I really, really would love to. I had a very lovely experience yesterday where a contact of mine was talking about a tour that is being planned, and I can't say too much about it now, but he contacted a tech person in another country and said, I'm thinking of touring this artist, would you like to tech on that? And they went, oh yeah, I'm a huge fan of the podcast, super keen. And I was like, so stoked. Like, that is lovely. It is really nice to know that people enjoy listening. Sometimes I've got no idea what I'm talking about. But yeah, I really do love putting this podcast together because it feels like me, it feels like something completely relaxed. It feels like I'm not doing it for the purpose of building a career out of it. I'm doing it because it's fun. And I love conversations with people. Obviously, I'm talking to myself today and a couple of times already, and I will be connecting with people. So if there are particular people you'd like me to chat to, let me know. You can drop me a line. I'm kc@kcmartinstone.com. If you don't know particular individuals you would like me to chat to, but you want me to chat to a person that does a particular thing, like if you're interested in a certain kind of archaeology or a certain career type, yeah, let me know and I will hunt them down and stick a microphone in their nose. Well, not up their nose, like that's uncomfortable, but, you know, in their face at some rate, very, very nicely. Yeah, I've got a friend I'm going to invite on the podcast. He has indicated he's keen, and he's a history curator and also a taxidermist, and I think you are going to love that episode. There's so much to talk about with him. I think we might even have to make it a couple of different episodes. And yeah, I will have more women on the podcast. I've got some trans guests lined up, which I'm really keen to talk to, who I'm really keen to talk to. And because that's one of the things I'm fascinated by in the way archaeology shows biases, is how do we read gender in the past? And trans people have always existed. Non-binary people have always existed. Gender and sexuality are constructed in cultures. And so I would love to break that down with a guest for whom it's personal. So yeah, if you've got other curiosities that you would like me to explore, let me know. I would love to hear from you. You can find me on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, all at Casey Martin Stone. You can send me an email, kc@kcmartinstone.com. And please, if you can, consider it. Have a think about becoming a Patreon, because as that grows, I will be able to do more and more and more of this. But thanks very much for listening, and hope you get out in the garden and you've been listening to Dig Me Up Later.